frequented it in battered boats and bulky barges pulled by diesel tugs. The afternoon after the grim session with the Reaper's body, the party started a leisurely journey westward. The cat encouraged them to concentrate on keeping life sign down, but Valentine's doubts prodded and pulled him out of his sublimation with hard staves. What if he failed to keep himself centered, as the cat liked to call it, and drew the hunting Reapers to his comrades like sharks to a blood trail? The others seemed so confident, talking about how they would take their first hood, discussing ambushes and crossfires and carefully planned traps. Valentine had barely survived his first encounter with a hood and heard again and again in his mind the terrible screaming of the steady, stolid Delvecchio as the Reaper's needle tongue found his beating heart. The plentiful wild rice and bullheads of the delta fed the five men on their bayou-bridging journey to the river. The wolves had grown so experienced in navigating the trackless morass that they hardly thought twice about wading or swimming a bayou in pairs and trios, one group always covering the other as they moved southwest. They reached the great river on a hazy afternoon 2 days later. Upon sighting it, Valentine forgot his doubts in the breadth and majesty of the current. Or perhaps it was just the change in the air after the miasma of the backwaters.
Two choices, boys.
Ever Ready had everyone gathered in a team huddle squat.
We build us a raft, or we go find the one we sunk after crossing over back in the spring. Might take a day or two to find the spot. We're just a little south of it now. If we build a raft, it means chopping wood, and that can be heard a long way off. Also, we won't stand a chance if we run into a patrol except to swim for it. If we go to the old boat and raise it, we'll have something a little more navigable. But I've got my doubts it'll even be there after all these months. The rivermen and patrols spend all their time along the banks, and chances are one of them already thumped it with a pole or a paddle, even if it is still underwater.
The wolves decided to vote, with Everready as a tiebreaker. Valentine was the lone vote for building a raft, as he saw little reward and a good deal of risk in blundering along the bank in search of the old aluminum fishing boat that had brought them across the first time. The others remembered a little too well the want of a nail lecture they'd received before departing for the Delta. It concerned coming home with weapons and gear issued, under pain of having to spend the next year on stable and livestock duty. So they turned north. Traveling the banks of the Mississippi made even the bayous seem like afternoon picnicking. The flooded and unattended banks turned the great river into a twisting mass of horseshoe loops and tadpole floods. Everready took what shortcuts he knew and always kept an eye to the river. Although they could spot a patrol boat long before the Quislings had a chance at seeing the wolves, every appearance of one of the noisy fiberglass cabin cruisers made them get under cover while it plodded back and forth across the river. The first day there were two such sightings, each one wasting over an hour. Valentine was jumpy the whole march. The others noticed it and put his mood down to bitterness over the vote on how to get across the river.
Ain't nothing here worth a boogeyman keeping an eye on.
Come on, Val. With that old gumbo stir up on point, we've never even been spotted, let alone walk into an ambush.
The gumbo stirrer in question waved from the crest of a small hillock ahead. Everready had spotted something, and the wolves obediently waited as the cat went in for a closer look at whatever it was. As Valentine entered the office, a breeze came through the open windows, but it was still uncomfortably hot, and the room had the sour smell of old paper. A young female guard in a white cotton uniform Valentine identified as a cadet's, her face as fresh as this morning's flowers, rose and smiled.
You must be the new wolf from Zulu Company, sir. Nice to meet you, Acting Lieutenant Valentine. My name is Cadet Lambert, but the guys here call me Dots, because I'm kind of a born picture straightener. I dot all the I's and cross all the T's.
You're well informed, Lambert. I didn't know you guards paid that much attention to the wolves.
There's one other wolf studying here right now, sir. She's from Tango Company over at Fort Smith. She stays at the pool boarding house. She's a little older than you. Her name is Carol Polisner. Usually the wolves don't have to do much formal classwork. Speaking of which, I have your packet already.
Thank you, Lambert. How the hell old are you, if you don't mind me asking? You look about 12.
He took a heavy pack of paper wrapped up in a tied linen folder from her hand.
I'm 15, but I passed the guard physical, and I ran the table on the written test. I'm the Colonel Commanding Staff Assistant until I turn 18. I actually prefer dots, sir.
Valentine knew the number of push-ups required to pass a guard cadet physical. He opened the linen folio.
The OTC is mostly self-taught. There's a reading list and written test on each book. You have to do 6 months' worth of lectures, unless you can pass out of the subject by taking an oral exam. The classwork is easier unless you're some kind of genius. Each week's lecture schedule is on the blackboard outside. Once you do that, and have your certificates of diligence, responsibility, and sobriety, you take the final oral exam. They hold those whenever there's three captains or above around. In fact, your Captain Lahav is going to be serving on one a little later this month. I hear he's merciless on grog recognition. If you don't know where to shoot a harpy to bring it down with one bullet, you're recycled.
Valentine was looking at the graduation requirements.
What's this thesis?
That's one of Colonel Jimenez's pet projects. Hope you can write. He wants a 50-page paper on any subject, strictly non-military. History is okay, as long as you keep off the wars and battles covered in the reading list. A week after you turn it in, you get questioned about it, so you better know whatever it is you're writing about. I did mine on the Great Mariners, Columbus and Cook, and so on. A week later, he was grilling me about how Columbus enticed his men to make the voyages and how Captain Magellan might have avoided getting killed. I think Jimenez just does it to keep himself sharp.
Thanks, Dots. I'll read this over. I'll start on the lectures this week if Lahav will spare me.
The cadet was already making notes in her desk book.
The library's on the top floor. You can check out books if we have two or more copies available, but that covers almost everything on the reading list.
Which building is the student union, Dots?
She looked up with a raised eyebrow.
Going to visit the creeps, huh? There's a campus map in your packet, but it's just across the quad. It's a good place to learn about the grogs, but I wouldn't let them talk you into trying for any bounty money.
Bounty money?
For all sorts of stuff. Reaper clothes or artifacts. Written records stolen from the Kurian zone. They offer big money for live prisoners, but if it's Quislings, they have to be officers. Their dreamcatch is a whole live Reaper. They had one once, but it got out. The Hub will look the other way if you grab a clipboard now and then, but don't ever try to throw a rope around a Reaper or he'll probably shoot you himself.
Thanks for the tip, Dots. I have a feeling I'll be saluting you someday.
If you need any help, I'm here every day. I live in the old dormitory.
Valentine exited past three guards who had quit skylarking and were talking over a broken-backed copy of War and Society. There were fewer than when he had entered. It seemed a couple of the number had duties elsewhere. The stone on the student union read L.A. Davis, Student Union, and 1952, but someone had hung a carved wooden sign that read Miskatonic University over the door. Valentine entered the unlit building, which smelled of bad plumbing. A stairway leading up had a sign reading Appointments Only, and a second notice board, which at one time had been behind glass, read Bounty Inquiries, Please Ring, over a small handbell. The second floor was a warren of rooms, some with doors completely missing and others with darkened windows. A faint, Poe-esque tap-tap-tapping sounded from an inner chamber. Valentine hunted the source of the sound, which he eventually realized was a typewriter. It came from a central office with three overburdened desks, festooned with pin-filled maps and drawings of grogs. Under a bright electric desk lamp, a rotund and hairy man typed with two fingers and an occasional thumb. The mountain man mass of hair on his head and face made his age hard to guess, but Valentine put the man in his late 30s, as his temples and chin were just beginning to be flecked with gray. He wore large, octagonal, tortoiseshell glasses that had probably been originally worn by a woman. A bare chest that would have done a grizzly proud, fur-wise, bulged out of a sleeveless jeans jacket. Valentine's knock broke the typist's concentration.
Hi, can I help you?
I think I'm supposed to help you. Are you one of the people who researches the Kurians?
Yeah, I sometimes think research isn't the right word, though. We're more like witch doctors trying to explain why a volcano erupts and throwing in the odd virgin to see if that helps. I think we used to put New Order Studies Institute on our documents, mostly because it acronymed out as nosy. But whoever we are, we're them.
Valentine entered the office, making his way around the desks and floor-filling mounds of binders to reach the scientist. As the latter stood up to shake hands, Valentine noticed that his pants were around his ankles.
Oh, sorry.
It was difficult to tell if he was blushing behind the beard.
Warm up here, you know. I swear that light bulb puts out more calories than candle power.
He brought his trousers up to their conventional position. Valentine took the hairy-knuckled paw he was offered.
David Valentine, Wolf, originally out of Minnesota. Pleased to meet you.
David Walker O'Connor, from Indianapolis, myself. Ran away at the tender age of 13. I was brought here just because I knew about current conditions in Indiana, more or less, and stayed on. I read you took a reaper outside of weaning about a year ago. What have you got for us now?
Do I talk to you? Well, it's about a feeling I got when a reaper was around, a couple of weeks ago. A cat named Everready thought it was important enough that I should tell you about it.
O'Connor scratched himself under his shovel beard.
Let's go into the cellar. I need a break and a drink. You like root beer?
Yes, thank you. In fact, it'll be a treat. I've only had it once or twice.
The researcher grabbed a notebook and led the way out of the tangle of airless offices. The two descended into the cellar. At the base of the landing, a classic pawn shop barred door and window prevented further penetration. O'Connor pulled a ring of keys from his pocket and selected one. The pathetic 40 watts from a single bulb did little to help the darkness, and nothing at all to alleviate the musty smell coming from piles of clothing, trunks, and assorted boxes and crates heaped with artifacts.
A lot of it is junk, but it helps put together a story.
Something shuffled out of the shadows, slab-skinned, inhuman, peering at them with a gargoyle face.
What?
Valentine reached for his absent weapons. O'Connor put a comforting hand on his shoulder.
Oh, easy, Valentine. This is Grishnak. As you can tell, he's a grog. A couple of the team found him after a battle, badly wounded. We patched him up, fed him. He's something of a mascot. He puts up with all our little experiments, don't you, Grish?
The researcher thumped it affectionately on the arm. The grog cocked its head from side to side, half closing its eyes. Valentine touched its thick horned skin.
Does it talk?
He gets by with a few meaningful grunts. He's a bit of a firebug. We can't let him have matches or a lantern or anything. Loves to watch things burn. They all do, from what we can tell. He's a living table scrap disposal. He thinks corn cobs are a real treat. Potato peels, too. Would you like a root beer, Grish?
Valentine looked at the half-dozen badly healed bullet wounds in the creature's leg and abdomen. A long knife scar also ran across its shoulder and down its armored chest. It unrolled its tongue.
Grish loves root beer. Let's sit down.
Valentine listened to the small noises of the empty building.
There's more than just you to this institute, I suppose.
An icebox devoid of ice sat next to a slop sink, and a card table stood under the inadequate light bulb. Shelves held a few dishes and cups. O'Connor drew three drafts from a scratched plastic barrel resting in the icebox.
Oh, there's one other scholarly fellow like myself around now, and he keeps even stranger hours. We have a couple of would-be students, but they have to scratch a living, so they work in the day.
The grog held out both hands for its sweet drink and scuttled off into the shadows with its cup.
Ha! Just as well. He's kind of messy when he drinks from the cup. I think Grishnak is pretty dumb, even for a grog. They have a language, but they don't use writing. They send little runestones in hollow bone tubes to communicate over distance. And the beads in their hair are kind of like military decorations, family totems, stuff like that. But back to the Institute. The rest of the team is in the field. Our elder sage is up around Mountain Home. I don't know if you heard, but 5 or 6 reapers are on the loose up north, well within free territory, and they're causing quite a problem. They're moving around faster than word of them travels, and every time it seems like they're cornered, they slip out. There's bad weather up north, and that's hurting things.
He solemnly opened his notebook and licked the end of his pencil.
Okay, Valentine, what's the story?
Valentine relayed the events at the Mississippi crossing for the second time in as many days. O'Connor scribbled.
And you can't link the hair-raising feeling to anything you heard, saw, or smelled. You're positive?
I guess I can compare it to... Let me see. The feeling you get when you're next to a window on a very cold winter day. Like the heat is being pulled out of your body. I can't put it any better than that. Or a feeling I got once crossing under a high-voltage line in the dark. I knew something was above me, but I couldn't say what. How would you describe an itch to someone who's never had one?
I couldn't. You've smelled a reaper, right, since your invocation is a wolf?
Valentine nodded, relishing the smooth sweetness of the root beer.
Very up close. Everready held an impromptu dissection of one before we pulled out of the Yazoo. It smelled like an awful heap.
O'Connor thought for a moment. He leaned back in the tube steel chair.
There have been a couple of incidents like yours. Not just wolves, either. A few people have a sensitivity to reapers. A lot of animals are the same way. We think it's because of smell, but we've seen too much weirdness in the past 40 years to discount anything, including psychic powers. If it keeps happening, try to figure out at what range you sense them. If it makes a difference, whether there are more than one, whether they can be distinguished as individuals, stuff like that.
Can they tell who's who by our life sign?
According to the Life Weavers, they can't, unless they're really close and it's a good read. Life sign varies with mood, whether the person is just eaten, stuff like that. Of course you guys learn to disguise it. Distance seems to matter most of all. Like you can recognize movement from a long way away, tell a man from a woman at a certain distance, and then distinguish individuals up close. Of course, it helps if you've run into the person a couple of times. But back to your question. I think they can tell who's who under certain circumstances. There have been incidents where the Reapers have gone after a specific person. I don't know if it was bullshit or not, but we had a report from New Mexico about Reapers gathering from miles off to hunt one of the wolves out there. I guess his squad split up and they all went after the one. Of course, life sign reads better in the desert. There's less interference from plants and animals, and they might have just been chasing the best signal. Odd coincidence that it was someone who had done them a lot of damage, though.
By the way, there was a funny design on the boat, kind of a bent X.
That's good that you noticed it. Can you remember it well enough to draw it?
Valentine reached for the pencil and beneath the researcher's notes traced out the design.
You're sure it faced that way, not like this?
He drew a Third Reich swastika.
No, it was facing the other way. Is it important?
Hard to say. It's been showing up lately, so I did some checking. That symbol can be found on temples in the Asian subcontinent, on Buddhist artifacts, as well as over here in American Indian cave paintings. It appears in the ruins of Troy, on Egyptian walls, even in China. I will say this, whoever used it in prehistoric times sure got around.
Arkansas, spring of the 42nd year of the Kurian Order. Valentine spent the winter months in diligent pursuit of his commission as lieutenant. While learning about interior lines and maneuver in the face of the enemy in the classroom, he became acquainted with the idiosyncrasies of oxen and pack mules in the field. He would wheedle 6 different calibers of ammunition out of the arsenal during the day and construe Clausewitz at night. He finished a thesis on the argument for objective reality, defending Socrates against Protagoras and Gorgias, after earlier arguing about the quality of the latest barrel of flour with the demanding camp wives. An astute observer with a detailed memory, Valentine molded his conduct after the officers he respected. He admired Lahav's methodical planning of every company movement, each leader knowing his assignment so well, the captain would often issue just 2 orders in a day of march: strike the tents at dawn and make camp at dusk. The company functioned as a well-tuned machine from the moment its commander hit the on switch. He appreciated Lieutenant Mallow's role as senior in amplifying and following up on his commander's orders, and copied Brostjev's devotion to his men in supplying their every want. If Valentine also avoided Mallow's indecisiveness in the absence of clear and specific orders from the captain and Brostjev's binge drinking, it showed that he could learn how not to behave as well. His men liked him, and what was more, respected him, for the simple reason that he showed them respect. The guards attending the officers' training college chided Valentine for his drab deerskin clothing and his shyness. He avoided the boisterous weekend outings, a fixture of college life since education began, and kept quiet in class unless called on. He remained silent about his experiences, even with the other wolves who dropped in occasionally as students and lecturers. He grew to know the scholars of Miskatonic Hall, read some of their raw files concerning the Kurians, and listened more than he talked. These traits, but especially the last, proved rare among the alternately bitching and bragging young wolves. Still, Valentine felt lonely and fell into the trap of pretending to prefer being alone, thus leading to further loneliness in a vicious circle of solitude that young men of a certain temperament build for themselves and then inhabit. But apart from the lack of companionship, he enjoyed his time as an acting lieutenant more than anything else in his life up to that point. The constant challenges, physical and mental, stimulated him. Zulu Company saw action twice that winter, but owing to his studies and lack of experience, Valentine remained back at the reserve camp with the sick and other dependents, commanding a squad of equally discouraged wolves responsible for guarding the cumbersome wagons and baggage. Marksmanship contests for the non-combatants and rehearsing musical follies to welcome back the returning wolves provided comic relief for the men's tensions, and every time one of his squad smuggled a woman into an isolated teepee, Valentine pretended not to notice. By the first silent green explosion of spring, Zulu Company moved from Pine Bluff to the Wachita River, returning to active duty. Northern Minnesota, the 39th year of the Kurian Order. He grew up in a pastoral setting among the lakes of Upper Minnesota. David Stewart Valentine was born during one of the interminable winters in a sturdy brick house on Lake Carver. The scattered settlements of that area owed their survival not so much to resistance as to inaccessibility. The Kurians disliked cold weather, leaving the periodic sweeps and patrols of this area to their quislings. The reapers come only in the summer, in a macabre imitation of the fishermen and campers who once visited the lakes between May and September. In the first few years after the overthrow, myriad refugees supported themselves amid the abundant lakes and woods of what once had been known as the Boundary Waters. They exterminated the remaining disease-infested rabies hot zones, but the settlers refused aid to would-be guerrilla bands, as most of them had already tasted reaper reprisals elsewhere. They wished nothing more than to be left alone. The Boundary Waters people were ruled only by the weather. A frantic period of food storage marked each fall, and when snow came, the families settled in for winter, ice fishing for survival, not sport. In summer, they retreated into the deep woods, far from the roads, returning to their houses after the reapers were again driven south by the cold. Young David's family reflected the diaspora that found refuge in the region. He had a collection of Scandinavian, American Indian, and even Asian ancestors in a family tree whose roots stretched from Quebec to San Francisco. His mother was a beautiful and athletic Sioux from Manitoba. His father, a former Navy pilot. His father's stories made the world a bigger place for David than it was for most of the children his age. He dreamed of flying across the Pacific Ocean the way some boys dream of being a pirate or building a raft and drifting down the Mississippi. His early life came to an abrupt stop at the age of 11, on a cool September day that saw the first frost of the northern fall. The family had just returned from summer retreat to their home, but a quisling patrol or two still lingered. Judging from the tire tracks that David found later, two trucks, probably the slow, alcohol-burning kind favored by rural patrols, had pulled up to the house. Perhaps the occupants were also liquor-fueled. The patrol emptied the larder, and then decided to spend the rest of the afternoon raping David's mother. Attracted by the sound of the vehicles, his father had died in a hail of gunfire as he came up from the lakeshore. David heard the shots while gathering wild corn. He hurried home, accompanied by a growing fear that the shots had come from his house. David explored the too silent house. The smell of tomatoes, which his mother had been stewing, filled the four-room cabin. He found his mother first, her body violated, her throat slit. Out of spite or habit, the intruders had also killed his little brother, who had just learned to write his own name, and then his baby sister. He did not cry. 11-year-old men don't cry, his dad said. He circled the house to find his father lying dead in the backyard. A crow was perched on the former pilot's shoulder, pecking at the brains exposed by a baseball-sized hole blown out the back of his skull. David walked to the Padres. Putting one foot in front of the other came hard. For some reason, he just wanted to lie down and sleep. Then the Padres' familiar lane appeared. The priest's home served as school, church, and public library for the locals. David appeared out of the chilly night air and told the cleric what he had heard and seen, and then offered to walk with the padre all the way back to his house. The saddened priest put the boy to bed in his basement. The room became David's home for the remainder of his adolescence. A common grave received the four victims of old sins loosed by the new order. David threw the first soil onto the burial shrouds that masked the violence of their deaths. After the funeral, as little groups of neighbors broke up, David walked away with the padre's hand resting comfortingly on his shoulder. David looked up at the priest and decided to ask the question that had been troubling him.
Father Max, did anyone eat their souls?
Every day at school, they had to memorize a Bible verse, proverb, or saying. Often there was a lot of writing down and not much memorizing. Sometimes the lines had something to do with the day's lesson, sometimes not. The quotation prescribed for the rainy last day of classes had an extra significance to the older students who stayed on for a week after the grade schoolers escaped the humid classrooms for the summer. Their special lessons might have been called the facts of death. The padre hoped to correct some of the misinformation born of rumor and legend, then fill in the gaps about what had happened since the overthrow, when Homo sapiens lost its position at the top of the food chain. The material was too grim for some of the younger students, and the parents of others objected. So this final week of class was sparsely attended. David Valentine was now 17. The padre pointed to the quotation again as he began the afternoon's discussion. Father Maximilian Argent was made to point, with his long, graceful arms and still muscular shoulders, 63 years and many long miles from the place of his birth in Puerto Rico. The padre's hair was only now beginning to reflect the salt and pepper coloring of age. He was the sort of pillar a community could rest on, and when he spoke at meetings, the residents listened to his impeccably enunciated voice as attentively as his students did. The classroom blackboard that day had 14 words written on it. Written in Father Max's neat scripted handwriting were the words, "The farther backward you can look, the farther forward you can see." Winston Churchill. Normally, Valentine would have been interested in the lecture, as he liked history. But his eye was drawn out the window, where the rain still showed no sign of letting up. He had even used the leaky roof as an excuse to shift his desk to the left so that it pressed right against the wall under the window, and the chipped white basin where his desk usually sat was now full enough with rainwater falling from the ceiling to add a plop every now and then as punctuation to the padre's lesson. Valentine searched the sky for a lessening of the drizzle. Today was the final day of the field games, and that meant the cross-country run. If the councilman canceled the games because of weather, he would finish where he now stood in the ranking, third. The youths came from all over the central boundary waters to compete against others in their age group each spring as part of the general festivities that ended the winter and began the great hideout. This year, Valentine had a shot at winning first prize. Second and third place got you a hearty handshake and an up-close look at the trophy as whoever came in first received it. The prize for boys aged 16 to 18 was a real over-under shotgun, not a hunting musket, and 50 birdshot shells. A good gun meant a bountiful hunting season. The padre and David needed all the help they could get. The padre taught more or less for free, and Valentine didn't earn much at his job chopping endless cords of firewood for the neighbors. If Valentine won, he and Father Max would be dining on goose, duck, and pheasant until well after the snow flew.
Mr. Valentine, please rejoin the class. We're talking about a very important subject, your heritage.
Doyle leaned forward from a desk behind.
Funny, I don't remember him saying anything about what a stupid son of a bitch you are.
The padre cracked his knuckles in a calloused fist. Profane jokes out of Doyle were as natural as water dripping into the classroom when it rained. He evidently chose to ignore both, keeping his eyes fixed on David.
Sorry, Father.
Valentine spoke with as much contrition as a 17-year-old boy could summon.
You can apologize to the class by reviewing what you know about the pre-entities.
This'll be short.
The padre shifted his gaze.
Thank you for volunteering 2 hours of your free time to school maintenance, Mr. Doyle. The roof and I are grateful. Your summary, Mr. Valentine.
They go back to before the dinosaurs, Father. They made the gates, those doorways that connect different planets. The inner world tree. It's how the Kurians got here, right?
Father Max held up his hand, palm outward. The thumb was missing from his right hand, and his remaining fingers were misshapen. They always reminded Valentine of tree roots that could not decide which way to grow.
You are getting ahead of yourself, Mr. Valentine. Just by 65 million years or so.
The Padre sat down on his desk, facing the 8 older students. The classroom should have contained 40 or so, had all the teenagers within a long walk attended. But education, like survival, depended on initiative in the disorganized boundary waters. Valentine settled in for a good listen, as he always did when the Padre parked himself on the desk in that fashion. The rest of the class, not having the qualified joys of living with the Padre, did not know, as he did, that when the Padre perched there, he was imitating another teacher from his own youth, a determined San Jose nun who had woken a hunger for learning in the ganja-smoking teen he still had trouble imagining the Padre had been. Valentine's mind insisted on wandering off to the games.
We know so very little about these beings, the pre-entities, except that they predate everything else we do know about life on Earth. I was telling you about the Doors yesterday. No, Mr. Doyle, not the old world rock and roll band. I know we think of these Doors as a terrible curse, the cause of our trouble. Everything we know would be different if they had never been opened. But long ago they were marvelous things, connecting planet after planet in the Milky Way as easily as that door over there connects us with the library. We call the builders of this interworld tree the pre-entities, because we are not even sure if they had bodies, in the sense that you and I have bodies, that is. They probably didn't need our little chemical engines to keep going. But if they did have bodies, they were big. Some of the Doors are said to be as big as a barn. We know they existed because they left the Interworld Tree and the Touchstones. A touchstone is like a book that you can adjust by laying your hand on it. They don't always work correctly on our human minds, however. There are always a few who touch them and go insane from the experience, which I find easy to believe. But a person with the right kind of mind who touches one has what we might call a revelation. Like the downloads I was telling you about when we were talking about the old world's computer technology.
The Padre looked down and shook his head. Valentine knew the Padre had a love-hate relationship with the past. When he was in his cups, he would sometimes rave about the injustices in the old world, which had the ability to feed and clothe all of its children but had chosen not to. This might lead to tears over missing something called McDonald's fries dipped into a chocolate shake or overpriced souvenir t-shirts.
The pre-entities existed by absorbing energy, a very special kind of energy produced by living things. Plants make it at a very low level. All animals, us included, possess it to a greater extent. This energy, which we call a vital aura, for lack of a better term, is determined by two factors in an organism, size and intelligence. The latter predominates. A cow, despite its size, gives off a smaller vital aura than a monkey being the brighter of the two, in more ways than one, if you understand.
A student held up her hand.
You talked about this before, but I never got if the aura was your soul or not. Is it? I mean...
Elaine Cowell was a 13-year-old, but so bright she stayed for all the lessons with the older teens.
Good question, Miss Cowell. I wish I had an absolute answer. My gut feeling is that a vital aura is not your soul. I think your soul is something that belongs to you and God, and no one else can interfere with it. I know some people say it is your soul that gets fed on, but there is no way we can ever know that. I think of the vital aura as being another special kind of energy you give off, just as you give off heat and an electromagnetic field.
Elaine fixed her gaze at an invisible point 16 inches in front of her face, and Valentine sympathized. She was also an orphan. The Reapers had taken her parents 5 years ago in Wisconsin. She now lived with an aunt who scratched out a living weaving blankets and repairing coats. The others sat in silence. Whenever the Padre discussed the facts of death with the older students, their normal restlessness vanished.
So why aren't they still around? I thought that energy stuff was what made the Kurians immortal.
Evidently, our creator decided that no race can live forever. no matter how advanced their science. When they started to die, we think it caused a terrible panic.
The lieutenant was not at the rendezvous. The tired recruits and tireless wolves rested for 4 hours. At dawn, the sergeant set Vaught on his horse with three wolves to scout the other side of the two-lane metal bridge spanning the Missouri. The land sloped upward as the wooded hills began beyond. Safety. One of the rear guard, at a copse of trees half a mile up the highway, waved a yellow bandana. Samuels clapped Valentine on the back.
Come on, son. You deserve to see this after last night. Everyone else get across the bridge.
He jogged off northward along the edge of what was left of the road, and Valentine followed. They reached the stand of trees. One of the wolves had a spotting scope resting in the crotch of a young oak, pointing down the highway. Valentine could make out figures in the distance, but he was unwilling to believe what he saw. Samuels looked through the scope.
They must have got wind of us last night. Not sure how many of us there are, so they're going back to report. Take a look at this freak show, Valentine.
David put his eye to the scope. The enemy. They were apish figures, sitting astride a long pencil of flesh. The mount was like a shiny, slug-skinned millipede. Hundreds of tiny legs moved too fast for the eye to follow, reminding him of a finger running across a piano keyboard. The riders, five in all, had armor-like gray skin that reminded Valentine of a rhinoceros's hide. Their shoulders were wide, almost two axe handles across. They carried guns that looked like old Kentucky long rifles held pointed into the air like five waving antennae. Valentine wondered if he could even aim one of the six-foot weapons.
They're even uglier from the front. Those are 50 caliber single-shot breech loaders, Valentine, and they're handy with them. They can blow your head off at 1,000 yards if you're fool enough to be visible and not moving.
Those are grogs.
Valentine couldn't tear himself away from the eyepiece. The sergeant retrieved the scope.
Those legworms are fun to stop, too. Brain is at the tail end, kind of like thinner here. Nothing up front but a mouth and some taste buds, I guess. Also like thinner here, come to think of it. Nothing short of a cannon will keep a legworm from coming at you. Good thing they're kind of slow.
One of the other wolves nodded in agreement.
We try to pick off the riders, but the lead one always has a big riot shield, thick as tank armor. We have to get them from the side. One thing you do not want to ever see is about 50 of them coming at you in line abreast.
That happened at the Battle of Cedar Hill. We lost.
They made it across the Missouri on a Sunday. The sergeant led them in a prayer of thankfulness that their long journey was almost complete. The next few days had briefer, harder runs, mixed with walks and 10-minute breaks. They stayed away from the roads, and the grog patrols stayed out of the hills, as each side considered this border region bushwhack ground. Around the campfire one night, Samuels told Valentine a little more about his father, how the Lifeweaver Row had created a special body of men to fight the Reapers and their allies, the Hunters.
He told us that these things had come to Earth once before. Some of Roe's people had taught men how to fight them. We'd forgotten it, except maybe as legends and myths garbled over the years. They took certain men and made them a match for what they were up against. Roe said he could do the same now if we were willing to accept the bargain. But it would change us forever. We'd never be the same people again. Your father was willing. Soon he had the rest of us convinced. That was the beginning of a lot of hard years, son. But when you get to the Ozarks, you'll see that it was worth it.
The lieutenant was waiting for them at Round Spring Cave. It was a road-hardened group that was welcomed by the officers in charge of training new blood in the Ozark Free Territory. A welcoming banquet was spread out under the trees. 6 weeks' worth of traveling on foot made the feast even more welcome. There was fresh bread, watermelons the size of hogs' heads, meat from the fatted calf, the fatted hog, and the fatted chickens under the summer sky. Valentine ate an entire cherry pie at one sitting for the first time in his life. Another little cluster of would-be soldiers had arrived the day before, youths gathered from the Missouri Valley in the Dakotas. They swapped good stories and bad in the pseudo-hard-bitten fashion of youth. Gabby Cho shared a picnic table with Valentine under a spread of pine trees. The fresh, clean scent reminded him of Christmases before the death of his family. Valentine was experimenting with iced dandelion tea sweetened almost to syrup. The tea, ice in summer, and apparently plentiful sugar were all novelties to him.
We made it, Davy.
She looked a little older now to Valentine. She had chopped her long black locks after the second day of hot marching out of the boundary waters.
I wonder what's next. You're in with these wolf guys. Any idea what's up?
Not sure, Gab. I'd like to spend a few days sleeping.
Cho seemed unsure of herself.
Why'd you join up?
Valentine shot her a questioning look. Cho had remained distant on the whole trip south whenever any personal topic arose. She politely rebuffed the other recruit's attempts to get to know her. He rattled his ice in the pewter mug, enjoying the sound and the cool, wet feel.
You probably think revenge because of the whole family thing. You know about what happened, right?
Yes, David. From some of the guys at class. I asked the Padre about it once. He told me to ask you, but I didn't want to do that.
Well, it's not that.
Are you sure? A voice in his head asked.
I know now my dad was with these wolves. Maybe he would have wanted me to do it too. He must have thought it was worthwhile. He spent a lot of years at it.
Valentine paused at a rustle overhead. Squirrels, attracted by the masses of food, were chasing each other around in the tree branches, sending flecks of bark falling onto the pair below. They were cute, but they made a decent stew, too.
I want to make a difference, Gab. It's obvious. Something's not right about the way things are. You know that Jefferson stuff we used to read? About being endowed by our Creator with inalienable rights. It's like those rights of ours have been taken away. Even the right to live. We have to do something about it.
As simple as that?
As simple as that, Gabby. What about you?
Did you know I had a baby?
Valentine absorbed the news in awkward silence, then cleared his throat.
No. You just disappeared from school. Went north with your family, I thought.
We kept it quiet. The father was a patroller.
She read Valentine's eyes.
No, it wasn't like that. I knew him. His name was Lars. Lars Jorgensen.
David got the feeling that she had not said the name in a long time.
He used to give me stuff. Nice clothes, shoes. I never thought to ask where it came from. Looted stores in Duluth, I figured. One day he gave me a watch. A real working watch. I could tell there had been engraving on it, even though he had tried to scratch it off. I told him not to give me any more presents. He disappeared when I told him about the baby coming.
Who's got the kid? Your mom or...
Scarlet fever got her. Last winter. Remember the outbreak? It hit around where you were living, too. It took...
Jesus, Gabby. I'm so sorry.
She wiped her eyes.
I think about it too much. I talked to the Padre after it happened. I thought maybe I didn't take care of her right, not on purpose, but because of how I feel about the father. I just didn't know. The Padre put it down to a lack of qualified doctors. Or if they're good, they don't have the equipment or medicines. The Padre said that lots of people he knew put this kind of thing behind them by helping others. He gave me a lecture about the need for strong bodies and good minds. Got talking about the cause. Well, you know him.
I wonder if I do. He didn't talk to me like that.
She smiled her I've got the right answer smile from school.
I think he knew you would go south when the time was right. I wanted to tell you all this for some reason. I feel like someone has to know the real me here.
The recruits got the word from Captain Steam Engine Fulton. He gathered them on a little slope in a ring of trees. In this natural amphitheater, he spoke to the mass of youths from Minnesota, the Dakotas, and a smattering of Great Plains outposts.
You will form a reserve regiment for now. You will receive uniforms. You will be armed, and you will be taught how to use those weapons. You will be paid, but not for fighting. Your main duties will be as disciplined labor force to be moved about the free territory, helping the residents at harvest, improving the roads, learning about how things are organized on the Ozark Plateau. The harder you work, the more there'll be to eat over the winter.
The bloody-minded and the phony tough guys groaned at the news. But Valentine grinned at Cho. A gun, a uniform, and something he had heard about but never seen, a paycheck. He couldn't wait to get started. The Ozark Plateau, the 40th year of the Kurian Order. An island of sanity in the eye of a hurricane of death, the scattered farms and towns of the Ozarks are a civilization under siege. The heartland of the region is bordered by the blasted ruins of Little Rock to the south, in the west by a line extending from the western Wachitas and Fort Scott to Springfield, Missouri, in the north by the far-flung foothills of the Ozarks and the Mark Twain Forest, and to the east by the St. Francis River, known by some as the Ozark Free Territory and by the more military-minded as the Southern Command. The region supports 750,000 survivors. They are mostly farmers and ranchers connected by a network of poor roads and unreliable rivers flowing through the worn-down remnants of America's oldest mountains. Heavy stands of oak, hickory, and pine give these hills a bluish tinge, fed by cool streams winding through limestone gorges. The small mountains have bare patches of exposed felsite and rhyolite, rocky scars that symbolize the flinty hardness beneath the exterior of the inhabitants. New farming centers have sprung up to replace the old. Little clusters of homes huddle together like medieval villages, stone walls with narrow loopholes facing the world, doors, windows, and porches facing the neighbors. The squatty settlements, perhaps built by men whose motto is "build for safety, not for comfort," are linked by walls that do not divide home from home, but separate houses from the outside. Corrugated aluminum barns and Quonset huts in the center of the ring of homes shelter livestock and machinery from the elements and thieves. Some areas are electrified, and a substantial portion use natural gas. A ham radio network maintains communication. Telephones are back in action, but service is unreliable. The suspicious and tough-minded residents dislike strangers, and they sleep with rifles and shotguns handy. Pack traders traverse the area with stock on muleback or in gaily painted wagons, bringing basic necessities and a few luxuries. Both necessities and luxuries are paid for with barter, sometimes with greenbacks. Perhaps a measure of the success and fortitude of the inhabitants of what used to be southern Missouri and much of Arkansas is their acceptance of paper currency as being worth something. But as gold coins can be changed at $2,000 or more dollars to the ounce, paper money's value is not what it once was. A regular Judge Advocate General Civil Relations Court, called the Jaggers, in a tone suggesting the word has an obscene connotation, rides circuit and brings some measure of order and law to the lives of the residents. A few towns operate in the region, home to the artisans and technicians that keep society together. There is still singing in Branson, and a riverboat casino is in operation on the White River, paying out prizes in a system of Byzantine complexity. A governor resides in Mountain Home, Arkansas, trying to keep the roads open and mail running on shoestring budgets. The soldiery, as the residents know them, are concentrated in the Wachita Mountains to the south and in the broken Ozark Ridges to the north. Ceaseless long-range patrols circle the area, picking up information and refugees from all points of the compass. Strong cavalry reserves train constantly in the center of the region, ready to go to the border to slow invasion or destroy a raid. Although the Ozark Free Territory is relatively safe, it is not impregnable, as small holders and settlements in the boundary areas learn the hard way. The uniform combined the comfort of burlap with the durability of cheesecloth. How innocent cotton minding its own business could be turned into such a scratchy, sagging patchwork amazed Valentine. And the rifle. It was a single-shot breech loader, operated by a lever that flipped out the expended case of the bullet. Woe to the recruit who failed to collect the hot brass thimble, as it opened the chamber for the insertion of another round. At least, that was the theory. In practice, a few shots heated the action sufficiently to soften the thin brass encasing the heavy bullet, and Valentine became better at clearing jams than shooting the quickly fouled weapon. It kicked like a mule and aimed with the ease of a steel shovel. However, it had few moving parts and was within the manufacturing capacity of the Ozark Free Territory. The pay was the biggest joke of all. The recruits received multicolored military scrip, usable at the scattered to the point of inaccessibility Southern Command Trading Post commissaries and accepted by a few pack traders desperate enough to take it in return for merchandise that failed the caveat emptor test everywhere else. Fulton pushed them through 2 months' worth of drill and an exhausting 6 weeks. A few recruits bristled at the discipline and gave it up after the first week, either trying the dangerous trip home or finding work on the farms and ranches of the territory. The majority finished their training under the supervision of bellowing NCOs. They ran and memorized the simple common articles that governed them and the territory. They ran and sat through lectures about recent United States history, about the other knots of the resistance in Oregon, Arizona, the Appalachians, and New England. They ran and practiced with their rifles, as well as the captured support weapons and the simple cannon produced in inadequate factories. They ran and learned about camp life, brain tanning, drying and smoking meat, planting, foraging, and where to find medicinal herbs. They ran and learned about running.
Fall out!
Labor Private Valentine learned to recognize the divisions of Southern Command, guards, militia, and hunters. The largest body of professional soldiery was the Guards. They provided a solid core for the defense of the Ozark Free Territory. Sometimes the NCOs and officers were veterans of the Lifeweaver-trained hunters. The Guards reinforced the militia, the first line of defense for most communities. Most able-bodied adults, especially in the border areas, belonged to the militia. They drilled with the Guards one day a month and stood ready to assemble at the call of drum, whistle, or siren. The hunters carried war into the Kurian zone. Trained by the Life Weavers, they were divided into the wolf, bear, and cat castes, each with a unique duty to the cause. At talks given by members of the castes, Valentine learned that the wolves carried out long-range patrol duties and maintained communication between the other commands across North America. The cats, rarely seen in the territory, served as spies and saboteurs across the country, often leading double lives deep in the Kurian zone. The bears fought as the shock troops of the cause, the Reaper's most fearless and skilled enemies. A hunter usually started as a wolf, and some of the best stayed as wolves rather than moving to a different caste. There were a few that knew all three of the hunter's arts, as they named the Life Weaver's disciplines, but all fought and sacrificed together to bring mankind back to a place in the sun. Back at the cabin, like a demon invoked by mention of his name, word from the Life Weaver waited in the form of a small printed list. The cabin was empty save for Seth and Sailor Tom, both napping in front of the Franklin stove.
Amu's called an invocation.
Big Seth spoke from his modified bunk. Reinforced wooden wings accommodated his 6'6" frame and supported an elongated mattress of his own making.
Starting Saturday, running for a week. 115 fresh wolves in this bash. Thank God.
Nice to see the roster growing this year. Many's a summer we had less than the year before.
Pankow reached for the typed sheet of paper.
Let's see the list. Oh, Marquez made it. Bad news, Valentine.
He watched Valentine's face fall.
You made it, Valentine. In fact, you're last on the list.
Valentine felt ambivalent at Pankow's joke, but a little pride still crept into his voice.
At least I made it, even if I'm dead last.
Now, don't take it that way, son. It ain't a good or bad thing being last, just means they may want to take more time.
Doing what? Tattoos? A Vulcan mind meld? What?
Hell, Valentine, where did you come up with that? A little before your time, and they haven't done reruns in over 40 years.
My dad liked to read science fiction. The man who brought me up after he died taught me to read my dad's books. But what is this transformation you all keep hinting about?
Big Seth and Pankow exchanged a look. Pankow shook Valentine's hand.
You'll just have to meet Father Wolf and see for yourself. Magic, son, is a little hard to explain.
The week dragged on, and Valentine made it pass more quickly by devouring the few books in the cabin. A heavy snowstorm came, and the wolves relaxed the tough schedule shared by the two aspirants. Valentine gratefully retreated to his bunk. Pankow gave him a pamphlet written by his foster mother. Printed in heavy, slightly smeared type and cumbersomely titled Fallen Gods, the history, theory, and practice of the Kurian Order. It was 50 pages relating the history of the Lifeweavers, their schism over the use of vital auras to attain immortality, and the Kurian takeover of Earth.
The Kurians failed in their first effort to take Earth because it was chaotic, badly planned, and they had not even consolidated their victory on Kur itself, where knots of Lifeweaver resistance slowed them. Humanity owes these brave souls a 4,000-year debt of gratitude. Mankind, in its primitive, isolated state, was less vulnerable to the spread of the rabies plague and quicker to accept the word and help of the Lifeweavers. We hunted the horrors that came over from Kur, closed the doors, and having eradicated the threat, promptly forgot about it 200 years before Stonehenge was built. Vampires became rumor, then legend, and the caste of the bear trickled down into human legend as the berserkers of the Norse sagas. Certainly a Kurian or two remained on Earth, lurking in untraveled corners of the globe, and Kurian-designed spawn, now known generically as Grogs and individually through slang and names out of mythology, no doubt survived to trouble humanity now and again as it pushed back the borders of the unknown. But though the gates of the Interworld Tree were closed, the Kurians in their red-clouded underground world learned in the long years of their exile how to open new ones. When and where the first of the new portals were opened is a matter of some dispute. Even the Lifeweavers are unable to say. It could have been as early as the Dark Ages in the Balkans, or as late as the 18th century. Opening the portals requires enormous sacrifices of vital auras to achieve. But after the first Kur came through the new gate or gates, humanity aided the Kurians in this all too frequently. Humanity took the first step toward its own overthrow. Over the years, the Kurians recruited human allies, perhaps by striking Faustian bargains. The Kurian moles gained positions of trust and authority in society. With the new millennium, the dragon's teeth sown in the last 100 or so years of man's history were ready to grow. In the first week of June 2022, they sprang the trapdoor on the vital auras of Earth's 7 billion inhabitants.
The door to the cool room opened noisily, and Gavino entered the cabin. He walked over to the hearth, apparently not seeing Valentine, and took the jug of Busthead down from its place on the shelf. Gavino collapsed in the leather-webbed camp chair by the empty fireplace, took a long pull, and stared at the cold ashes. Sailor Tom took advantage of the warm lap, and Gavino scratched the cat between the ears without looking at it. Valentine considered greeting him, but didn't wish to be given something to do. He returned to his booklet.
The Overthrow. The world was already a miserable place in the spring of that cursed year. The new depression was at its height. Stocks fell, jobs were lost, and consumer consumption fell in a corporate death spiral as the aging technozars were revealed to have feet of clay. Financial institutions underreacted, the government overreacted, and a society living on borrowed time, paid for with borrowed dollars, failed. Hard times and hunger came to the Western world, which was all the more of a shock because the generation that survived the last financial collapse had virtually died out. Ancient hatred smoldered and burst into flame. Europe saw its first real war in generations over food tariffs. China used America's preoccupation with its economy to overrun Taiwan. Russia and Japan, both backing different factions in Europe and the Pacific Rim, started a naval war that the United States, in its last great overseas commitment, stopped by cordoning off the two powers. Civil unrest over the use of American wealth and resources abroad, with so many suffering at home, erupted into violence. Paramilitary groups took a hodgepodge of economic, political, and even racial grievances to the ultimate court of violence. A few polarizing and charismatic leaders further unraveled the tattered American social fabric. The Earth itself added its cataclysmic voice to the dissonant chorus of human suffering. A worldwide string of earthquakes and volcanic eruptions leveled cities and made ash-covered wastelands of regions near the volcanoes. Particles in the atmosphere changed the climate more to the Kurians' liking. As if the tectonic damage was not enough, a plague added to the chaos. People called it rabies, but its 24 to 72 hour incubation cycle and mind-altering effects made the cure seem more like a job for exorcists than doctors. Wild mobs tore through the cities in a biting and clawing frenzy that shattered civic order. It was not even suspected at the time that both events were long planned. Kurian technology allowed the fallen Lifeweavers to use the Earth itself as a weapon, and the disease, which we know today as raving madness, had appeared on Earth in the first Kurian invasion. The pale, robed Reapers began to walk the night. The Reapers strode into the maelstrom, alternately cowing and killing. They commanded legions of Grogs, genetically altered creatures designed to break up opposition. As fearless in battle as army ants, the most common form is a large rhino-hided ape with hands and brains capable of using weaponry from assault rifles to armored personnel carriers. The military and civil forces of the United States, already unable to deal with the plague and widespread destruction, succumbed as spare parts, ammunition, and especially morale ran out. A few Kurian agents and collaborators in the command structure helped orchestrate defeat on a grand scale. In the final extreme, a scorched earth policy destroyed military bases and their equipment to keep them out of the hands of the Kurians. A few nuclear and chemical weapons were used in the last gasp of the war. But this added to the suffering rather